From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When he was a child, Percy Carey, a.k.a. M.F. Grimm, was a regular on Sesame Street. When he grew up, he became a rapper and drug dealer. A murder attempt left him in a wheelchair. A narcotics conviction put him in prison. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Percy Carey about his life and how he's changed it. He's written a graphic memoir called Sentences, The Life of M.F. Grimm. Also, we remember the fabulous Moolah, a leading wrestler on the women's circuit from the mid-50s through the mid-80s. She died Friday at the age of 84. And film critic John Powers reviews Terror's Advocate, the new documentary about a lawyer notorious for defending terrorists, war criminals, and militants. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Percy Cary, a.k.a. M.F. Grimm, is probably the only successful rapper to have gotten his start on Sesame Street. He may also be the only Sesame Street alum who became a narcotics dealer and barely survived a murder attempt by rival dealers. The bullets paralyzed him from the waist down. In 2000, he was sentenced to life on narcotics and conspiracy charges. In prison, he studied law and filed countersuits. His sentence was reduced, and he was released in 2003. Percy Cary tells his story in a new graphic memoir illustrated by Ronald Wimberly. It's called Sentences, The Life of M.F. Grimm. Now Cary's business is legit. He runs his own underground hip-hop label called Day by Day and has returned to recording. Here's a track from his 2006 triple CD American Hunger. It's called Page Six, named after the gossip page in the New York Post.
The world will help you climb, cause they love a superstar. Someone has to crash and burn, so they love a superstar. And yes, I'm a superstar, darling of PR. Paparazzi shoot from close and far, even in private, no moments alone. I heard he's been through hell. Do his rap music really sell? Among the elite, will he prevail? Is he on his way back to jail? Red Daddy shot it out with the cops. Beat his ass until he dropped. Threw him in a cell, told him to rot. Who do he know and how did he get out? Can he walk? Cause I heard he's wheeling. Over drugs involving dealings. Shot 10 times, do we have feelings? Heard he's violent, do we have feelings? Got a girl, do we have feelings? Life story so appealing. Not just us, okay, globe inquiring minds, they all wanna know.
Percy Cary, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, your book starts with you getting shot during a blizzard in 1994. So let's start there. You were on your way to sign a record deal with Atlantic Records. You were driving with your brother Jay in a blizzard. What do you remember about the attack?
Well, actually, the car was parked, and it was just snow all over the place. We were getting into the car. Couldn't see anything. The windows were covered with snow. It was coming down hard. And actually, the last thing I remember and will never forget is the fact that Jay said that today was going to be the first day of our life, of our new life.
Because of the record deal?
Yes. You know, there was no looking back. You know, we didn't have to do things that were considered, obviously were considered illegal or just not law-abiding, period. And, you know, we were looking forward to it. We were looking forward to a different type of life.
So then what happened?
From there, that's where the gunfire started. And was shot several times.
Your brother Jay was killed pretty instantly. How many times were you shot, and where were you shot?
I was shot 7 times from my neck. I had a bullet ricochet in my head and come out my mouth. Arm, sides, back, just multiple shots. I look like a Dalmatian, to be honest. But all around, mostly mid-body.
Do you know who attacked you? Not that I'm expecting you to name them by name, but, I mean, do you know who it was? It sounds like you don't want to say.
actually, it's just that it's so I put that so behind me that I don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that because at that time and the things I was doing, I put myself in that predicament. So I'm just as guilty, if not more guilty, than the people who actually shot me. So to make a long story short about who shot me, yeah, I'm aware who shot me, you know, in my own way, in my own sense, because I've done a lot of things myself.
Do you remember when you came out of the coma and realized that you were partially paralyzed? I think at the time you still didn't have Your hearing and your vision hadn't returned yet?
No. I was blind, I was deaf, and I was paralyzed. But there were things, those were things that I didn't even pay attention to, if it makes any sense. Okay, the sight, that kind of automatically, you're like, what's going on? I can't see. You know, the hearing, I was aware that I was shot, you know, and I had a bullet in my head. So the ringing and the non-hearing, I've dealt with. The paralysis itself, it didn't dawn on me because I knew my body went through a certain amount of trauma. So my assumption was I couldn't move just because of the trauma, not that I was, any nerves were severed or things of that nature. So it took me some time to understand that I was paralyzed.
How much of your body is paralyzed now?
I'm what's considered a T4 paraplegic, thoracic fourth bone, which is like right under my chest. You follow
mm-hmm,
me?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm paralyzed from there down, but it's interesting because all my sensation came back. A lot has changed. I was told that I was severed and I would be like that the rest of my life. A lot has changed since that time. So to state what type of paraplegic I am is difficult because I'm considered T4, thoracic, but I can feel all the way to my toes now.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that's great.
I can slightly constrict my muscles and start moving somewhat.
After you were shot and then survived, you ended up going back to the life you were living beforehand. You ended up going back to that gangster kind of life and dealing drugs again. And I guess I'm wondering, why go right back into that world where you're likely to be shot again?
Well, I have to say, in my point of view, it's economics, because if I wasn't in this chair right now and I walked outside and I tried to get a job, it would be very difficult for me to get a job. It's not impossible, but it would be difficult. To be in a wheelchair with my record and things to that nature, it made it harder to get a job. I've attempted to get employment and work in even pet stores. I've tried everything, and it was difficult. I was on Social Security, SSI. I was receiving, I believe, $200, $300 maybe a month to live off of. Food stamps, I believe it was like $70 a month to live off of. And that's not including the fact of medical supplies, medical situations. Like if I needed medical supplies, I paid for it. And bottom line, I'm also a distributor. I don't know if you're aware of that, but I have a distribution company, music.
Oh, Day by Day Records.
That's Day by Day Entertainment. Yeah, it's an international distribution company. So I deal with companies around the globe, Australia, Japan. So it wasn't all just about selling drugs. It was, for me, it was to try to make a transition.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the narcotic itself was something I was able to get my hands on because it was available, and I chose to take that and sell it to make a profit so I can put into myself.
I guess, you know, I'm wondering why you got into the gangster life and dealing drugs in the first place. And I ask this because...
Temptation.
Wait. Yeah, well, let me just go backtrack a second and say that you were, like, really lucky when you were a kid. I mean, you were one of the kids on Sesame Street. So,
yes.
Like, on your resume, by the time you were a teenager, you had Sesame Street. So, I mean, there's so many things. As a performer, as somebody who wanted to, like, make records, like, you really could have used that to help parlay that into a career. So how did you end up in the gangster life as opposed to just kind of heading right towards show business?
Well, I have to say, up to that period of time, you're talking about, you said like 14. Before that, yes, I was on Sesame Street. It was great. I've done several other things in between, I mean, go all the way up to about, I guess maybe I was 10, 11.
Mm-hmm.
But 14, that was a different age, and it was a different era. I don't want to say I fell into any type of peer pressure, but temptation itself is a test that man has been going through since the beginning of time. And not every man has successfully overcome it.
My guest is Percy Carey, a.k.a. M.F. Grimm. His new graphic memoir is called Sentences, The Life of M.F. Grimm. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Percy Carey, who's also known as the rapper M.F. Grimm. His new graphic memoir, Sentences, tells his story from being a regular on Sesame Street to becoming a rapper, a narcotics dealer, and surviving a murder attempt which left him paralyzed from the waist down. You did time on charges of dealing narcotics and having illegal guns. You got out on bail for $100,000, and on the last day of your bail, you spent that day recording an album, a CD.
Yes, yes,
that's called correct. The Downfall of Iblis. Correct me if I'm not saying that correctly.
No, that's correct.
Subtitled A Ghetto Opera. And
yes.
How did that feel to record an album knowing that next day you're going to be in prison? And it was, at the time it was 15 years to life. You ended up getting out after 3 years, but you didn't know that would happen. So you're facing 15 years to life and you're recording an album. Just describe how that felt that day in the studio, knowing what lay ahead of you.
That was the beauty of the album, because I didn't know what lied ahead of me. So creating the songs, I believe most of those songs were really questions to myself of what's going to become of the future. It was an album that I didn't have no answers to. Like every other album I have, as far as I'm concerned, are answers. It's my reply to how I see the world and things of that nature. But that was the only album that I had no certainty whatsoever of my future.
I want to play the track Howl. Would you say something about it before we hear it?
Well, Howl is I basically compare life in America, or at least a specific type of style of life, to the life of being in a wolf in a wolf pack. So it's like Nature Channel.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is Howl, and this is M.F. Grimm.
In darkness, sometimes sunshine, drunk off death, throwing up moonshine, slit veins, sit still, crush all bones, brittle, no pain, quick kill, maybe hurt just a little, hunger on cellular, yes, we call you, don't have a prayer, say one for you, shake life out, body in throat, sink veins, today's your last day, too slow, can't hang, don't take personal, but you must die, kill or be killed, we kill, that's why make it easy on yourself when the wolves bite, accept your fate, no struggle, don't fight, alpha omega, pack overpower you, reminiscing as a pup while we devour you, all my wolves blow, we thirst, kill with purse spoon, we howl, jump, 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 temptation, hunger, pain, please Lord forgive me.
That's M.F. Grimm, who's also known as Percy Carey, from his album The Downfall of Iblis, A Ghetto Opera, which he wrote on bail the day before he went to prison on narcotics and gun charges. Now he has a new book. It's like a graphic novel, but it's not a novel, it's a memoir. It's called Sentences, The Life of M.F. Grimm, and it's about his life as a kid on Sesame Street, where he was a regular, as a rapper, as a drug dealer, as a prisoner. It's about all of that. As we said, you recorded that album right before going to prison.
Yes.
How did you deal with distributing the album and getting people to listen to it while you were behind bars?
Actually, I write a lot of letters, mostly to stores, buyers. I sold my CDs right from prison. There's, for instance, Fat Beats. You got Amoeba Music. You have Sandbox. There's so many mom and pop stores, and then one stops and distributors that I just reached out to all of them while I was incarcerated, and I kept my communication with them open.
How did it sell?
It did well. I think it sold at the time, I think it was like 12 or 24,000. I really don't remember. Because it was a while at the time, you know, which was great.
You write in your book that you had a drum machine that you hid hid in your cell. How did you manage to get it in the first place, and how did you keep it hidden?
Okay, when I was in I was in a maximum security prison. There I wasn't allowed to have any type of drum machine. But when you get to a medium security prison, you're allowed to have an instrument, like, you know, like a drum machine, long as it's under a certain amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
So I when my classification went down, I bought it. I purchased it. But for some apparent reason, I really don't remember why, I ended up in going to somewhere and being into solitary confinement. They put me in like what's called the box. But I snuck it in there with me. I put it under my seat and I brought it in. And I just created music while I was sitting in solitary confinement. They had an electrical outlet and it worked.
Did you have to keep the volume really low so the guards wouldn't hear?
Oh, no, you can't use it like with speakers or anything. Only headphones.
Headphones, of course. Yeah. Right. Something else to keep hidden.
Yeah. I used to throw my coat over my head and just lay there or sit in my chair with my and just tap on my drum machine. And really they didn't pay any attention because I was already in solitary confinement and it's dark, you know, it's like one little glass mirror, that's about it. And they walk by every 45 minutes, so you know, it was cool.
Why were you?
It saved my life.
Why were you in solitary?
See, that's what I'm trying to remember. Why at that particular time? I think it was a conflict of interest. The fact that I was in, I believe I sued, the Department of Correction for $3 million. Because it wasn't wheelchair accessible, and I was denied work release at the same time because of my disability. So sometimes they would make it hard for me. They would put me in different little spots, different places. They kept moving me around, and I would sue every facility I was at. So they would get tired of it, and they would just throw me in the solitary confinement sometime until they could figure out what they would do with me. Or they'll shoot me back upstate. You know, it became a game.
Now, when you were shot, you went back to the gangster life. You were dealing drugs. But when you got out of prison, you changed your life.
Yes.
Why did you change it then?
My grandmother passed while I was incarcerated, and when she passed, it was like it was the last straw. I was like, okay, this is how you want her to remember you. This is how you want to be remembered. You know, her grandson is locked up in prison, you know, and she's gone now. You know, my grandmother was a very well-loved and respected woman. And it broke my heart knowing that the last image of me was the fact that I was in prison. And for me not to be able to redeem myself in her eyes, you know, it haunts me. That was the wake-up call.
Now, one of the things you've done, I know you don't like to mention for who, but one of the things you've done is you've ghost-written some raps for some pretty well-known performers.
Yes.
Where does that fall in chronologically? Was that before or after prison?
Actually, that was way before prison.
Uh-huh.
That was in my younger age. Mm-hmm. I have to say from like teens, from like 14, 15, 16, 17. Mm-hmm. You know?
If you mentioned, and I'm not asking you to, but if you mentioned who you had ghostwritten for, would they be angry because it would make them seem less authentic if they hadn't written their own raps themselves?
Yes, definitely.
Is that frustrating for you?
No, not at all. Because it's I put it equivalent to the fact of when at my time period, my younger age of deciding to try to be in the streets or try to sell drugs or things of that nature. It's something that I chose to do and I knew the outcome of it. So it's the same with being a ghostwriter. There was a lot of people that they offered me money to do these things. It was, certain things were exclusively just for them. Certain things were supposed to be silent, and you have to respect that. It's funny because I've written for record companies where they would take a song and chop it up and give it to like three different artists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I've seen a lot of strange things.
Percy Carey's new graphic memoir is called Sentences, The Life of M.F. Grimm. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Baby, it's no secret that I want you. We can have fun if you want to. I see it in your eyes. It's like you're hypnotized. Your scope ain't got you open cause you want me. You told me that you have a man, though. All you gotta do is let his hand go. I want you rain to shine. You know your heart is mine. No matter the weather, we can stay together. You feel the energy. Advanced chemistry. Outcome is heavenly. Let yourself go. And lady, follow me. If you focus, believe me. Off it will pay. Life could be wonderful.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Giant's House, A Story of the Unlikeliest of Lovers by Elizabeth McCracken. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org. And from the NASDAQ Educational Foundation, dedicated to innovation and entrepreneurship around the world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember the fabulous moolah. Mary Lillian Ellison died at age 84 after a long career as a champion wrestler, trainer, and promoter on the women's circuit. Also, John Powers reviews a new documentary called Terror's Advocate, and we continue our conversation with Percy Carey, also known as the rapper M.F. Grimm.
I don't know where to start. You were my heart. You walked into the light. Now I'm sitting in the dark. I was locked inside the box. Before I even knew, an angel paid me a visit. He resembled you. He never said a word. Glared, disappeared. It was weird. Got on the phone, had a fear. Something wasn't right. What was the meaning of the sign? Found out you died. All I could do was cry, cause I was up in prison. Praying to the creator that you were still living. And this was a dream. Grab my skin, I'm pinching. Pinching so hard off the skin. Ripping. Reality is slipping away from me. Door resigned. Now I fiend. I had to think of something in a fast way to block.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Percy Carey, who's also known as the rapper M.F. Grimm. His new graphic memoir, Sentences, The Life of M.F. Grimm, is published by Vertigo Books, part of DC Comics. It tells his story starting in the late 70s when he was a regular on Sesame Street. When he left, he headed far away from that street. He became a rapper and drug dealer and was shot several times in a murder attempt that left him paralyzed from the waist down. He served 3 years on a narcotics conviction. Since his release in 2003, he's been running his own hip-hop company, Day by Day Entertainment, and recording his own music again. I want to go back to your early days when you were on Sesame Street.
Sure.
How did you get on it? Like, what was? How did they find out about you, or you find about, you know, how did it happen?
It was through a friend. One of my mother's close friends. She actually got me an audition, I believe, for Sesame Street. It was one of my mother's dear friends. She had a lot of ties with, I think it was called Reeves Teletape at the time. It was only like two blocks away from the house, Sesame Street. And she got me in there. But I had a manager, I think her name was Toby Gibson or something to that nature. You know, so went through the whole works, but it was through a friend.
So you already knew you wanted to perform?
You know what? I wanted to be a program director since I was like 5 years old.
You're kidding. No five-year-old wants to be. No five-year-old knows what a program director is.
You're talking to a 37-year-old man that when he was five, I was on Sesame Street and I would constantly question how did you, you know, like, how can you make us show people on this television? You know, and just, you know, create a world and then go to school. And everyone believed that that world was real. And I was fascinated that they would put it on at a certain time, what would come in between. I've always wanted to be a program director, especially of ABC, since I was a kid.
That's
I'm so from
great.
Upper West Side. Uh-huh. Think about it. I'm from the Upper West Side, Manhattan, uh-huh. 85th Street. ABC's right on in the 60s, so I'm a special child because I've always wanted to do that.
So how old were you when you were on Sesame Street?
From 5 years old all the way up to I believe I was like maybe nine. I'm at least nine, at least till nine.
And what was your part on the show?
I was Percy. Actually, I'm the first kid to ride Snuffleupagus. Yes, it's documented that the first episode of Snuffleupagus, when Big Bird meets him and wants to see him, I'm riding on his back, but he don't see Snuffleupagus and he just sees me riding, so. It's documented. It's on the net. So it's on the internet. You can find it.
So look, when you started rapping and you started, you know, hanging out with people like Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre and stuff, did you tell them that you were the first kid to ride Snuffleupagus? I mean, was that the kind of thing that would add or detract from your cred?
Nah, actually, I've never been ashamed of anything to that nature. But no, I didn't see it as beneficial just bringing up it and... When you're talking about, I've been offered to write Vanilla Ice, Ice Ice Baby.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
That was brought to me first. The producers, I know the producers. I know when you're a writer, mm-hmm. a ghostwriter, or you're a producer, it's a community. So all these things come across you. But it's funny, no. We didn't talk about Sesame Street back then, but I'm quite sure they admire me now for that. They have to.
Yeah, go ahead.
Everybody wanted to be on Sesame Street when they were kids, except me.
You didn't want to be on?
I wanted to be the program director. I wanted to put it together. I sat there long enough. I was 5 years old, seven. I realized that I can do this. I really wanted to put Sesame Street together, create new characters.
In a way, you eventually did that. It just, like, through having your own record company, your own, you know, your own distribution company.
Yes.
So, like, just connect the dots for me a little bit about how you got to be, you know, writing Snuffleupagus on Sesame Street to hip-hop.
That's what was in. That's what was done on the corners. It wasn't part of how can I say corporate America. It was part of growing up.
Mm-hmm.
If you grew up with graffiti artists, and if you didn't know how to do that, then you had to figure something out. There were breakdancers. I grew up around some of the greatest breakdancers in the world, Rocksteady Crew. I grew up around some of the greatest graffiti artists that they're world known. You have to find your place. But at the time, it was just things that, you know, you do. You do that to kill time. Or it's something that you really love. I became an MC. I was around some of the greatest DJs in the world.
I want to close with another track of yours. And this is from a 3-CD set that you put out not long ago. I think it was like 2006. And it's called American Hunger.
Yes.
And the track I want to play is the opening track, American Hunger, parentheses, Breakfast. and again, I'd like you to just, introduce it for us, talk about it a little bit.
Well, it's amazing because you picked American Hunger, Breakfast. That started it all. On American Hunger, obviously, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, it's the same actual sample.
I believe is The Windmills of Your Mind.
Yes.
Yes, the Marilyn Allen Bergman story. They were just on our show recently.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I couldn't decide which one I wanted to use, so I used all three different versions of it, and that's the reason why we decided to make a triple CD. That was the only reason.
Huh.
Yes. Otherwise, yeah, I couldn't put them all on one CD. It wouldn't be justified because I felt that it was powerful to be the initial one for each one. So I love it. I love breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Before we hear American Hunger, Breakfast.
Yes.
I have one final question for you. If you were programming your own TV station.
Yes.
And you could choose shows from any part of television history.
Yes.
What would you put on your TV station?
That's a good question. I love Channel 13.
That's the public television station in New York where you live.
Yes, yes. So I mostly documentaries I would focus on. I love the Nature Channel. I love the History Channel. If we're talking about just for me, it would be just history and nature and science. Definitely science, future. Learn what's going on. Weather Channel. I kind of like that too.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
What do you like about the Weather Channel?
Just the fact of watching them get it wrong every time, thinking that they're smarter than the creator. It's like, come on. But I have to say, if you're talking about just the Percy Channel, those that's what I would watch. Yeah, I like old Masterpiece Theater. Also, the shows from overseas, the UK back in the days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I would go with. Go with that.
Well, it's really been terrific to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Man, you made me feel at home. I really appreciate it.
Percy Carey, his new graphic memoir is called Sentences, The Life of M.F. Grimm. He has a new M.F. Grimm CD called The Hunt for the Gingerbread Man. Here's the track we were talking about from his CD, American Hunger.
Trying to get regurgitated because I am the feast. For hundreds of years and infinite tears, with no remorse, they took us all to war. I was told you're a sinner to become a winner. Then you must put faith in the Lord. I do not choose to lead you astray, but for me, prayer don't help no more.
Over here we eat our young American hunger. Vegetarians are bloodthirsty. American hunger. Oh no.
Trapped in the belly of the beast,
and it's a fight to get released. Damn, it's hard being black in America. We're under attack in America. In the belly, cause a gas to America. Start come out that of America. They don't want us here, they hunt us here. Lynch mobs kick in our doors. They torture us as our women and our children. Watching all 2008, not just black anymore. New objective, target poor. Those who resist, raise up a fist. Yes, blood must be spilled on floor. They gun us, overrun us, anything to have control. And on J
judgment day when all pay. May God have mercy on their souls. In the media, we're portrayed evil constantly.
Coming up, we listen back to an interview with the fabulous Moolah, a leading figure on the women's wrestling circuit from the mid-50s through the mid-80s. She died Friday at the age of 84. This is Fresh Air. The fabulous Moolah was a championship wrestler on the women's wrestling circuit from the mid-50s through the mid-80s. She was also a trainer and promoter. Her real name was Mary Lillian Ellison. She died Friday after shoulder replacement surgery. She was 84. In 2005, she was featured in a documentary about the early days of women's professional wrestling called Lipstick and Dynamite. At the time, Ellison was still working on the circuit as a promoter and occasional wrestler, even though she was in her 80s. In 2005, Ellison and the director of the film, Ruth Lightman, spoke to our frequent guest host, Dave Davies. Dave asked Lightman about how women first got started in wrestling.
There was a legacy that led back to the late 30s, that there were these women from economically challenged backgrounds that were recruited to the road by one promoter named Billy Wolf. And he basically had men, other wrestlers who were wrestling in territories all over the country that would see women in diners and in shopping centers, and he would pick them up and offer them $50 and send them to Columbus, Ohio for a chance at becoming a wrestler.
What were they looking for? Beauty, brawn, skill?
All of the above. Beauty, brawn, skill. They were looking for women who were very attractive and very athletic, and often on the spot they would say, you know, get down there and do some sit-ups for me, or show me what you can do, do push-ups. And so many of them were acrobatic and athletic. And basically, they were offered fame, fortune. Many of these women were sort of presented and marketed like movie stars. They wore furs and high-heeled shoes, and they were presented as showgirls.
As we listen to the stories of these women and how they got into it, I mean, there's some pretty tough survival stories here, aren't there?
They really were looking for a way out of some difficult home lives, so that they learned how to fight when they were young, because many of them came from abusive homes. They were ready to get out there and get into the ring. But it was also a way for them to have a career, and they really perceived it as a career. And some of them were able to do it for decades, especially Lillian and Mae Young.
And I think that's probably a good point. We can bring Lillian Ellison, the fabulous Moolah, into the conversation. Are you with us, Moolah?
Yes, I am.
Great. Should I call you Lillian or Moolah?
Whatever you want to, but if you write a check, just don't let it bounce.
All right.
I've been called a lot of things. I don't mind.
All right. Now, it said that you held the world title for 28 years, going back to 1956, right?
Yes, sir. I won it in Baltimore, Maryland in 1956 and lost it in Madison Square Garden in 1985.
Take us back to those days in the 50s a little bit. What were a couple of your favorite moves in the ring?
Favorite moves?
Yeah.
Anything I could get to win. I like to do the flying drop kicks and flying head scissors, and like to do flying mares.
Well, describe a couple of those for us.
Okay, a flying drop kick is when you jump flat-footed from the floor up as high as the person you're looking at and kick them in the face or in the chest, wherever you want to kick them. And then you fall to the floor. And then the flying head scissors is where you jump up, would put both legs around their head and throw them forward as you come down. And a flying mare is when you get a girl by the hair of the head and pull her over your shoulders and flam her to the mat as hard as you can. And I love doing that.
I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about what it was like in the ring and the crowd. I mean, they're yelling at you. Did you feed off the crowd? Could you hear individual people yelling at you?
Well, I'm gonna tell you, it's kind of hard to explain, but it just gives me a joy when I walk out to the ring and I hear people yelling. I don't care if they're yelling or booing. It just gives me a thrill to know that the people are there to enjoy themselves and enjoy the entertainment that we will be giving them. And then it's hard to explain because, like in the city in New York, I would go in the ring and I get everything thrown at me, from rotten eggs to rotten oranges and everything else. And then when I'd come out of the ring, they'd be tapping me on my back and saying, "Mula, we love you. You're so great. We love you." So it's hard to explain.
When you're in the ring, did you ever turn around and respond to anybody?
Oh, I yell back a lot, yeah.
Like, what would you say?
Well, I don't know, whatever it called for.
Lillian, why do you think you...
I would tell them to shut up, or if they thought they were big enough to climb inside the ring, I had something waiting for them, whatever I felt like telling them.
Were there rules? A lot of people, when they see wrestling, it looks like anything goes. I mean, were there rules about what you couldn't do in the ring? Like, for example, grabbing someone by their hair and throwing them into a turnbuckle.
Yes, there's rules, but everybody does not abide by the rules. And I'm one of them.
You're one that does not
always. I do my own rules. In fact, I don't mind wrestling men because I know their weak points.
Give me an example of their weakness. can you give an example of a rule that you bend?
Well, I wouldn't mind choking you, or gouging your eyes, pulling your hair, or kicking you below the belt. It wouldn't bother me at all.
Okay, well, I'm glad we're in two different cities here. Most of the other women in the film, Lipstick and Dynamite, went on to other careers, but Mula, you just stayed right in it. And I'm wondering, did you ever think about leaving? What kept you in the wrestling game all your life?
What has really kept me in it so long is that every year I got older, I could see people, senior citizens, sitting in a rocking chair, or either saying, "Oh well, I'm going to retire this year," and I'm in this. And when you do that, you can bet one thing, you're driving nails in your coffin. And I will be wrestling when I'm 100 years old, and I want the senior citizens to know, just because they're 60 to 65 years old, they do not have to sit in a rocking chair and rock, because when they do, they're rocking themselves to the grave.
Mary Lillian Ellison, a.k.a. the Fabulous Mula, died Friday at the age of 84. She spoke to our frequent guest host Dave Davies in 2005, along with Ruth Lightman. She's the director of the women's wrestling documentary Lipstick and Dynamite. Coming up, John Powers reviews a new Barbe Schroeder documentary about a lawyer notorious for defending alleged terrorists and war criminals. This is Fresh Air. Terror's Advocate is a new documentary in theaters by filmmaker Barbe Schroeder, who made Idi Amin Dada, Barfly, and most notably Reversal of Fortune, which won Jeremy Irons an Oscar for his portrayal of Klaus von Bülow. The new documentary is about a French lawyer who has made his name defending internationally reviled figures. Our critic John Power says that the film offers a look into the many forms of evil.
Everything has a moral, says the Duchess in Alice in Wonderland, if only you can find it. This could almost be a review of Terror's Advocate, a sprawling but riveting new documentary about one of the world's most notorious lawyers, Jacques Vergès. Over the years, the flamboyant cigar-smoking Vergès has defended the likes of Klaus Barbie, the Nazi known as the Butcher of Lyon, the sociopathic terrorist Carlos the Jackal, Serbian dictator Slobodan Milosevic, Holocaust denier Roger Garodi, that fine fellow Saddam Hussein, and various other clients who are euphemistically called controversial. As it happens, Vergès started off rather admirably. Born of a French colonial father and a Vietnamese mother, he was raised on Reunion, a small island east of Madagascar, where he was instilled with a lifelong rage at being looked down on by the pure-blooded French. Still, during World War II, he went to Europe to fight against the fascists, staying on to become a lawyer and an organizer against colonialism. He first became well-known during Algeria's struggle for independence from France, when he defended Algerian terrorists by arguing that they were merely doing what the French resistance had done against the Nazis. Along the way, he married one of his clients, Jamila Bouhirid, the model for the young woman bomber in the film Battle of Algiers. All this made Vergès something of a third-world hero. He even converted to Islam. But he's one elusive cat, and he soon abandoned his wife and child, disappearing for 8 years. Was he in Cambodia with his old comrade Pol Pot, the mass murderer he would later defend? Was he hanging out with Palestinian terrorists? Was he hooked up with Swiss Nazis or Congolese gangsters? Or was he really, as some suspect, a French secret agent? It's all murky. But when he reappeared and resumed his legal career, he remained mysterious even to those closest to him. Here, his Yugoslav girlfriend recalls a typical Vergès maneuver.
He had a very simple life. That's how he continued living in Paris. At the beginning. And then suddenly, he bought a full house of furniture. When he moved from Montmartre to Notre-Dame-des-Champs, it was a very big apartment, a huge, beautiful apartment. One day I came, it was full of furniture, big rugs, tapestry on the walls, old antique furniture.
Terror's Advocate was made by Barbe Schroeder, whose whole career displays a fascination with those who live outside the normal rules, be it the scabrous writer Charles Bukowski, murder suspect Klaus von Bülow, or Uganda's psychopathic dictator Idi Amin. Vergès is the slipperiest of the lot, and Schroeder knows better than to expect the truth from direct questions. Instead, the film takes us from witness to witness, country to country, slowly revealing how Vergès always appears linked to forces of international terrorism, with a special fondness for causes that are virulently anti-Semitic. In the process, he emerges as a genuinely brilliant provocateur. They asked if I'd defend Hitler, he tells Schroeder. I said I'd even defend Bush, but only if he pled guilty. Joking aside, Vergès is no clown, and his legal work reveals the unsavory side of our belief that every accused person deserves the best possible defense. He specializes in a form of moral jujitsu that flips a trial from being about the guilt of his clients to the culpability of a society that tries others for something it's guilty of itself. Thus, in defending Barbie, he argued that this barbarous Gestapo boss had merely done in France what France did in its own colonies. And although this is specious, Barbie was still guilty of crimes against humanity, it's not altogether wrong. The moral Vergès finds in such a story is nearly always the hypocrisy of nations holding others to enlightened values that they themselves routinely betray, which is one reason we must pay close attention to his sophistries. They force us to sharpen our own ways of thinking about terror and justice, about whether the civilian deaths caused by the Iraq War are morally different to the deaths ordered by Saddam. Not that Vergès cares what we do. The movie shows him to be a very happy man. The terror business has clearly been good to him. He lives in material comfort, skates across the world's front pages, and as terror's top lawyer, he uses his cases to exact his revenge on the France and the West that once treated him as a third world inferior. Beaming with self-satisfaction, he spends the movie quoting his own best lines and boasting how he's flummoxed opposing lawyers. He denies backing international terrorists, but his smile makes it clear that he likes us to think that of course he does, but that he's also too sharp to ever get caught. The smartest snake on the block, Jacques Vergès is the kind of enthrallingly sinister figure who makes every lawyer joke you've ever heard seem preeminently fair.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. He reviewed the new documentary, Terror's Advocate. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Ian Chillog, Joan Tui Westman, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. And from Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs creating a greener tomorrow, on the web at kauffman.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Katha Pollitt is best known for writing political columns from a feminist perspective in The Nation. Her new book is a collection of personal essays about subjects like web stalking her boyfriend after discovering he cheated on her, and what she learned about her parents from their FBI files. We'll talk with Katha Pollitt on the next Fresh Air.